This is actually an important story of our post 9/11 age, mm-hmm. and what we've come to for the whole world.
What they're doing is carrying over from their commitment to undermine markets, carrying that over to a commitment to undermine democracy.
I think the mass media are not friendly towards capitalism and corporate America, and they're not close to corporate America. They are corporate America.
We don't have the numbers yet. Hopefully we will, and hopefully it won't take too long, because by nature I'm not a very patient person.
When you're in a jungle and all you've ever known is hunting or being hunted by prey or predators, your entire worldview is predicated around that.
This is the Smells Like Human Spirit podcast. Go to smellslikehumanspirit.com for a full archive of all of our episodes. Join the Facebook community at facebook.com/smellslikehumanspirit. Peace.
All right, we are back. It's 2013 and we're here on the Smells Like Human Spirit podcast at smellslikehumanspirit.com. It's episode 40 and we're discussing education today with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. A lot of you listening will be very familiar with his fine work, not only on the Corbett Report, but on boilingfrogspost.com, globalresearch.ca and many other websites and sources. So James, it's great to be talking to you again. Happy New Year, and how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing absolutely fantastic. I'm looking forward to a new year and all sorts of stuff that's still going on and still needs to be documented, so I'm eager to be getting at it again.
Fantastic. So, talking about education today, and I'd like to start off by kind of tossing aside aspects of funding or any political sort of slant on education or any sort of debate on public versus private schools or anything like that. I'd just like to start by asking you, what do you feel the purpose of education should be?
That's a very good question, and I think fundamentally what I'd have to say is that the purpose of education is learning, not merely learning facts by rote and learning, basically memorizing names and dates and places, but learning how to learn, I think, is the most important aspect of education. And I think fundamentally that's what we should all be aiming for with our children and even ourselves. Because obviously this isn't a process that really stops. It's just a process that can continue for an entire lifetime. And I'm still certainly learning myself every single day. And I think it's really the things that I've learned about how to go about finding information and sourcing information and vetting information is much more important to me than anything that I actually learned, quote unquote, in school, in my own schooling experience.
That's such a good point. Well, do you think there's a suitable age to start teaching children the way they're currently being taught throughout the whole of their education? I mean, with data and everything like that. I might suggest teaching children about maybe caring for each other and, you know, appreciating their lives and, you know, this amazing planet we live on first. I mean, let's give like a moral standing. Let's have that at the bottom and then bring in the data. I mean, what do you think?
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that there's a minimum age to begin educating children, really. I mean, I think from the moment that they're born, you start educating them in different ways. Obviously, they're very, very limited in what you can do in the first year or so of its life. But obviously, there's things that you will try to teach your children right away, such as the danger of hot objects or sharp objects or something. And of course, you can kind of move up from there. But I think there's no such thing as a minimum age at which children will start learning, because they're learning from the moment they're born. Basically, they're trying to ingest all of this sensory data and make sense of it. And I think insofar as the parent or the guardian can play a role in overseeing that process and hopefully, you know, helping the child along in that way. But again, fundamentally, I think education is something that has to come from an internal curiosity. So I don't like to think of teaching in the traditional sense of sitting there lecturing to a child and just telling them about things. I mean, I think they have to be actively engaged in that process. But even so, I still think that even very young children can engage in that process. And I wouldn't say there's too young an age to start thinking about that.
Mm.
James, I have to give you credit for making myself, along with many other people, aware of this fantastic documentary entitled Children Full of Life. At least that's the loose English translation, which you can find on YouTube for anyone listening. It focuses on a Japanese teacher and how he relates to his students in the class, some young children. And what was really striking about this documentary was the focus on the emotional development of the children and the opportunities they were given to really express themselves and relate to the other children in class. Do you feel that these emotional aspects are purposefully neglected by a lot of the educational systems that we see in the world?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I'm going to speculate about the intent behind the absence of that type of education from the system. But for those people who haven't seen this documentary, first I'll just wholeheartedly recommend that they go and actually watch the video, because it's much more effective than simply talking about it. But long story short, it follows 1 year in the life of some grade 4 elementary school students in Kanazawa near Tokyo, and the class that's taught by Toshiro Kanamori. And basically, the documentary cameras just followed this class around for 1 year and sort of captured what they were doing and what the activities they engaged in and the sort of drama, both their sort of daily private dramas, but also what they did in class to sort of act that out. So it starts quite emotionally with one student talking about the death of her grandma, and basically goes from there, and it goes from basically those types of events onward, just looking at the way children deal with these events, as you say, in their emotional lives, and how other students can be supportive of that, and how they can work together as friends. There's problems with bullying, etc., in the class, and it's interesting to see the way that the teacher deals with that, as opposed to what I think we would be more used to in North America. So, of course, this does take place specifically in the Japanese context, and myself, having been a teacher in the elementary school system here in Japan, I often get asked whether this is kind of what a typical Japanese classroom looks like. And I have to say both yes and no. I think just like back in America or anywhere else in the world, there's good and bad teachers. There's teachers that are better suited and worse suited to dealing with children, I think. We'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, Mr. Kanamori here in this documentary is just a fantastic teacher who can genuinely really relate to the children and does an excellent job. And again, you have to really see the documentary to appreciate that. But I think there is more of an emphasis in the Japanese school system on, for example, group problem solving rather than simply having a teacher lecture to students, oh, don't bully each other because, you know, I'll be angry at you. Mm. Rather, the Japanese school system is ordered in a way that that from a very young age, children are usually broken into groups. And it's a question of groups having sort of an internal imperative to monitor and control each other's behavior, which right. I think there are good and bad things to be said about that. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, as we see in the documentary Children Full of Life, it can be a very empowering thing for the children to sort of sort through their own problems, obviously with the guidance of a teacher, but more as a teacher, as someone who will be there to sort of direct what they're doing. But the children themselves are very much actively engaged in talking through their problems and problem solving. And there's even a very interesting part of the documentary where they're engaged in a group project to create basically boats that they can put in the school swimming pool out of like homemade objects. They kind of construct these boats, but one of the children has been acting up the day they were actually going to go out to test these boats. So the teacher, it says, oh, well, you can't go then. You can't participate in this today. And since the kids have been excited for this for weeks and they've been planning and working together on this project, the entire group, his entire team, says, well, we're not going to go if this child can't go, because that's just not fair. And the entire class eventually joins in with this kind of boycott. And the teacher says, oh, okay, well, since you've stuck up for him, you know, we can all go together. Mm. And it's one of those things where you can tell the teacher is obviously kind of goading them into that, trying to make them stand up for their comrade, as it were. Mm. And that's the type of dynamic that I think I see at least more often here in Japan than I ever saw back in Canada, where it was kind of more of a teacher-student direct guiding type of instruction. So there are things to be said both in favor of and I guess against the system like that, but it is certainly interesting to see the way different countries and different cultures approach this subject, because we tend to think, we tend to normalize these things. What we grew up with is the way schooling is and the way it has to be. Mm. And when we denormalize that and we see it from different perspectives and different cultures, I think we can get a different understanding on what education can be.
Mm. Well, it's great to know that in different parts of the world, there is a different way of stimulating children's mind. There is a different form of education. I mean, that's, you know, it's very promising to be aware of that. But maybe in this Western world, I don't think education would stimulate children's minds enough for them to get the best out of themselves, to realize their true potential, and for them to reach happiness. And it, surely that should be the overall aim of education, to teach happiness. And maybe we can touch on that a little bit. And does society even care about how happy people are? You know, if not, then we should.
Well, that's a perspective that's been brought in. For example, instead of trying to measure the gross domestic product of a country and ranking countries that way, people have suggested that there should be a happiness quotient or that type of thing, quality of life type ranking of countries instead of GDP. And I think there is something to that. We have to take into account the well-being of people on a number of levels. But I don't think happiness is quite the way I would frame it. I don't think that the point of life is necessarily to be happy so much as to be fulfilled. And I don't think those two are necessarily one and the same. Although I guess you could make an argument that fulfillment is happiness. But but I think at any rate, there should be more of an emphasis on the emotional life of the children rather than children as robots who are expected to, you know, write down the answers on tests and simply grading them that way. Obviously, there has to be some consideration to the emotional and the overall development of these children into adults. And it really is a question of whether or not schooling as we've come to know it really is the only way, or B, the best way to go about doing that. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that in fact the entire system that we've grown up with has been sort of constructed not to genuinely provide any sort of emotional development or well-being for children as they grow into adulthood, but simply to turn them into those kind of robots that will function well on tests. And I think we have to really examine it at that level to understand what could at least possibly be a different way of looking at it.
It's very interesting, because going back to the aforementioned documentary, Children Full of Life, that happiness aspect that James mentioned there, is something that the teacher focuses on and reaffirms with the children. You know, that should kind of be the underpinning factor in whatever they do. But you mentioned fulfillment there, James. I'm just wondering, fulfillment of what? You know, when we say fulfillment, are we talking about our desires, ambitions? Are we talking, you know, some people would take that to mean financial success in one's lifetime. So just what does that mean to you, just out of curiosity?
Well, exactly right. You're right to point out that is kind of a slippery concept. And I think it necessarily has to be so, because I think one person's fulfillment is not going to be another person's fulfillment. And I think people have to find that in their own way. Certainly what interests and fulfills me as a human being, I wouldn't expect would be what interests and fulfills everyone else, let alone even the majority of other people. And I don't think we can have a one-size-fits-all solution to that. But I think fulfillment has to be something along the lines of allowing the child to discover and develop along the interests of what the child is genuinely interested in seeking and doing. So that can take place in a number of different environments and in a lot of different ways, and it can look different for different children. And I think, again, we have to be prepared to allow for that, because so much of what the school system as we understand it is about is standardization of children themselves, to try to turn out a sort of set product so that by the time someone is 18 and finally capable of living on their own according to what we've grown up with, they're capable of performing such and such function or reciting such and such names and dates and facts, etc. But obviously, I think we have to really transform our understanding of what it is that we're aiming at here. And I would rather have human beings who are capable of problem solving, understanding the world around them, and solving problems based on what comes towards them on their own without necessarily having to look for the guidance of a teacher type figure. And also, I think it has to be in some way at least preparing children for attempting to find what it is that fulfills them. Again, I don't think that there can be an answer to that. This is your fulfillment. This is what we're going to teach you. I think that has to, again, come from the individual themselves. And certainly by the time I was 18 or even 20 or even 25, I still don't think I had even begun to scratch the surface of what I was capable of as a human being. And I didn't even begin my website until I was 27. And I think that's when I started to realize what it is that I think I've been put on this earth to do. So I don't think this is something that necessarily has to stop when we reach a certain age or reach a certain attainment in the education system. Again, fulfillment is something that can be a lifelong quest, and it can take a lot of different paths for a lot of different people.
So with that being said, if we were to look at some of the world's education systems at the moment, to what extent do you feel they contribute to limiting people? To what extent do they contribute to social control rather than social upliftment? You know, a common refrain is education is the key. But there is a long history of governments and think tanks discussing ways that education systems can be used to suppress people from achieving autonomy and critical thinking. So just looking at the, of course, the wide spectrum of systems that we have, James, how far do you feel they contribute to that?
Well, the influence is quite apparent, really, when you start to look into this. And I know you started off by saying without looking at the politics or the history of this, but I really think that we would be best served to take a look at some of the history of the way that the schooling system developed. And I think it's also important for us to firmly differentiate between the concept of education and the concept of schooling, because we talk about education and how important it is, and then we talk about schools as if that is the only form of education. And when we fail to differentiate between that, we can get caught into a system whereby we support the status quo and everything that's already happening in our school system, and without ever thinking to question sort of the underlying belief that we do need to be putting these children through the school system as we've known it, and shipping them off to schools to be taught by teachers for 8 hours a day and come home with homework and all of that. The form of schooling that we all grew up with is not necessarily the only form of education. And when you start to actually look at the history of how the school system, the public schooling system, started to develop, and in what form and in what way, it becomes extremely apparent that the schooling system, as opposed to the education, the idea of education, was developed specifically as a form of social control. And we have this not, again, from any just sort of airy-fairy what we're making up off our head. We have this from historical documents and the writings and of the people who were involved in the creation of this themselves. We had, for example, people like the robber barons of the 19th century, the Rockefellers, etc., the Carnegies, who were demonstrably absolutely essential in setting up the schooling, the public schooling system, importing what had been a Prussian education system to, for example, the United States, and funding that into existence, starting a movement to try to make it a national standardized system, which would eventually lead into having a Department of Education with a national standardized curriculum. And all of this takes place in the context of the late 19th, early 20th century, amidst quite a bit of public backlash. It was by no means a straight line from A to B to go from the old forms of education to the public schooling system as we know it today. But because we have grown up in that system, and that system, that history of how the system came to develop isn't taught to us, we tend not to have much awareness of that and not to question it. So again, once we start to look at some of these historical documents and the figures that were behind them, we start to realize that there is quite a huge gap between education and schooling. And again, I think it serves our interests to start to take a look at where those two interests might diverge.
Absolutely. I think we've got to keep in mind that the younger a mind is crafted, then the more solid that thinking pattern becomes all the way to adult life. So when it comes to the endless pursuit of profit for businesses and national economies, do you think our minds are crafted through education to further this profit more so than getting the best out of people?
Absolutely. And again, this is not just a speculation or abstract philosophy. This is something that was definitely aimed at with the formation of the public schooling system and the mandatory education system, which was self-evidently and self-confessedly set up to produce better workers, basically. And it was quite explicitly aimed at that the schooling system would be able to produce children basically like products that would then be able to slot directly into the industrial society that had arisen in that late 19th or late 20th century. So that whereas hundreds of years ago, you might have had individual artisans and shopkeepers and people, farmers, etc., more rurally based, who were interested in having children who would be able to function in that society and be able to obviously help out with the family business, but also perhaps to better themselves and participate actively in social and civil life at that time. But you start to develop this notion in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that what we need to do is standardize everything for the standardized factories that had become the hub of the economic activity of the United States and much of the developed industrial world at the time. And so what you have is this system that wants to produce children that have become automated, have become used to this routine of clocks and bells, and you do this at this time, and then you stop when the bell rings, and you do something else at this time. And everything is regimented, everything is directed from a teacher to the students. There's no such thing as self-discovery, self-learning. It's all very much given from an authority figure to the children. And the basis of judging whether or not someone has failed or succeeded in this system is an arbitrary mark that is given by the teacher, again, from an authority figure to the students. So that at every single point, the idea is to try to eliminate as much of the individual human factors as possible and to try to inculcate a sense that everything comes from on high, everything is decided before you get there and will continue long after you go, that it's just a system that you can't really question. And of course that serves the interests of the industrial manufacturers of the late 19th century, who wanted very much that type of worker. Once that person turned of age and was able to work in their factories, they would have been used to and have spent their entire lives basically in a system that looked very much like a factory, where you go to work and you perform a certain function until you hear the bell or the whistle, and you have a break, and then you go back to work when the bell rings again. And it's just basically trying to create a system that inculcates the children to understand the world as if it were a type of factory or something like that, as opposed to a sort of more natural learning environment that would have been apparent in centuries before that.
You mentioned the presence of an authority figure there, James. Do you feel that growing up in a schooling system where, you know, that there is the ultimate authority figure of a teacher, do you feel that creates a damaging trust and reliance in people to get all the answers from the person in power? Do you think that has sort of long-lasting effects on us as we go into adulthood and beyond?
Absolutely. I think we do tend to internalize the structures, the social power and the structures of control that we see around us. And if we are put into a situation from basically the time we're able to walk and talk until the time we reach quote unquote adulthood, in which we are constantly monitored, controlled, regulated, and graded by an authority figure, we do tend to internalize that as the way that society functions and the way that it should function. Because again, we don't tend to question those underlying points of the system that have just been present for our entire lives. And when we start to internalize that and we start to think that that's just the natural way that things can be, I think that leads to all sorts of very important political and social and economic relations that become encoded into our society that, again, we never think to question. So that even from the perspective of myself, who at this point has finally, after years of struggle, broken free from the idea that we necessarily need a state to watch over us, it seems to be, from my perspective, that statism itself is propped up by this constant inculcation our entire lives that there is this higher power, this authority figure that will come down from on high to regulate us, control us, tell us what to do, tell us how to do it, and then grade us on our ability to do it. And we start to see society as a reflection of that. Well, we must have this authority figure there at all times telling us what to do. Otherwise, it would be chaos. And of course, if we look back to our own schooling histories, we might all have had that experience where, you know, if the teacher leaves the class, or if there's a substitute teacher or something like that, the authority has been sort of questioned or put into question for that period of time. Suddenly the class goes haywire and people are running around and doing whatever. And instead of questioning whether that might not be because of the system that as it's been constructed, and of course when you release the authority figure from that that system that requires the authority, something will happen. But instead of really questioning the fundamentals of why that's happening and whether there's a different way to imagine such a scenario, we just tend to think, internalize that and normalize that and say, well, that must mean that we always need authority figures watching over us, or we're all just going to go crazy and haywire. And that's the type of thing that it's so basic to our experience that we never think to question just how much the schooling system and the education that we grew up in can inform our view of society itself.
Mm. Well, it might only be a matter of time before a big screen in the room replaces the teacher as the authority figure in the classroom. But I don't know, we'll see what happens when it comes to that. But surely the constant use of computers is going to have a massive effect on the way we think in generations to come. It's almost like technology has swayed evolution down a slightly different path. What do you think, James?
There is no doubt that we are transforming as a species, really. I don't think it would be overblown to states to say that. And it's happening in a number of different ways. And I'm quite cautious, obviously, about the way technologies are incorporated into society and why specific technologies are forced on the population and how they're brought into the society, etc. Having said that, I think that there are positives to this, insofar as even at the time when I was going through university, I don't think it would have been as easy as it is today to completely and utterly circumvent the university education that I went through. It would have been possible. I could have gone to libraries and I could have researched topics myself and I could have learned myself. But I marvel to think at how much easier it is today to basically learn whatever it is you want to learn within seconds and basically almost for free. I mean, other than the cost of the computer and the internet connection, which even at public libraries, etc., you can get for free. So it is truly a revolutionary stage in human society, and I truly believe that we're still only beginning to understand the possibilities of what this represents and how this truly could transform, utterly, utterly transform our idea of what it means to be, for example, a child going through the education system and why we need to be basically putting them into classrooms every day to be overseen by a teacher when there's nothing that a teacher could teach them that they wouldn't be able to access on their own if they were so inclined. And so this raises the question of whether or not the schooling system as we've come to understand it is little more than a babysitter for these children. And I think that's something that will resonate with a lot of parents who think, well, obviously I can't have the children at home because I have to go out to work. So we need to put them in some place where they can be monitored and controlled all day. So that's, again, part of the sort of economic and societal structures which create the need, quote-unquote, for the school system as we've understood it. But, again, we are starting to get to that point where people can more and more take education into their own hands, quite literally, with the types of devices and technology that we have. And we're starting to see the beginnings of what this might look like. We're starting to see online courses that are given by even accredited universities and institutions for free over the internet. You can do self-testing and that type of thing. And it's really only a matter of time, I think, until people start really understanding what this means and the fact that, as far as I can see, the point of a post-secondary education in anything other than a very technical trade is just beyond me why people would go through that. Except, of course, that it is hardwired into our economy, that if you don't have a degree, then you're obviously not qualified for the work. So, again, there's a lot that we have to change in terms of mindset, but the technology to change the way we do things is already here right now.
You talked about the need to create change there, James. I'm just wondering, for any teachers that might be listening that feel they're hamstrung by a very rigid national curriculum or something similar, and they might be listening saying, well, this is all very nice, but I've got standards to meet and my kids need to pass their exams. What can they do, as someone like yourself who has experience teaching, what can they do to start to create some change in their classrooms?
Well, I sympathize with that position very much, because as someone, again, who was a teacher here in the public school system for 4 years, I very much understand that there's a vast chasm between what we would like to see in classrooms and then what can actually be achieved, given all the restrictions and restraints, etc. So it is extremely difficult, and obviously I don't think any individual teacher is going to be able to completely transform the system overnight. But I guess there are two ways of looking at this, and they're both, I don't want to come to a conclusion on one or the other, but I think there are both ways of dealing with this problem. And the first, I think we can see as the example that's set by teachers like Mr. Kanamori there in the Children Full of Life documentary, who obviously is teaching on a day-to-day basis and is involved in the Japanese school system, but he certainly does bend that system from time to time, and he certainly does allow the children to participate in their own education in a to a degree that I think a lot of other teachers wouldn't be comfortable with, or wouldn't even necessarily know how to do. But he's obviously quite good at that. He's obviously spent decades, you know, developing that technique. So that's the type of answer that some teachers might come to, that yes, I mean, at the end of the day, you still do have to teach this and this and this because it's part of the national curriculum, but at least you can sort of bend the format for how that's done, and you can try to challenge children to sort of rise to the occasion. And I wouldn't put that down. I wouldn't disparage that method, because of course it's not the type of fundamental revolutionary change that we'd all like to see, or at least I think we'd all like to see. But it is certainly a step towards something better. I mean, it's certainly demonstratively better to have children engaged in the learning process like that rather than to have them as automatons. So it is good to have people like Mr. Kanamori in that system. But the other way that teachers can go is to follow the example of someone like John Taylor Gatto, who of course was the New York State Teacher of the Year and won much acclaim and accolades for the way that he handled his students. And you can go and read his books or listen to his interviews and documentaries about Mr. Gatto. And he talks about some of the techniques that he would do, for example, if he saw a child in the back of his classroom drawing cartoons instead of like actually watching what was happening in the class. He would go and tell the student, well, if that's what you want to do, that's great, but that's a pretty terrible job you're doing right there. Why don't you go to the library and get some books out on how to draw comics, etc., and what types of how to sell your comics to companies, etc., and would make that into a project for the child. That sort of thing. Very, very progressive, obviously, ideas and some great ideas for how to really transform what was happening in the system. But eventually, he ended up coming up against the wall of how far you can go in such a system, and he ended up resigning quite famously on the editorial pages of the New York Times, basically saying that he couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't indoctrinate these children. He couldn't teach them how to basically hate themselves and pray for authority figures to come and save them, and how to become basically robots. And he laid that out quite well in his editorial of why he couldn't continue being a teacher in that system. So I could see, I mean, if there are teachers out there right now that are wondering how to educate within the confines of the public school system, there are those two options. The one is to try to see what you can do to bend the system from within, and the other one is to leave the system because it is corrupt to the bone. And again, I can't really pass judgment on people for how they deal with that, especially because, of course, a lot of people have their own families to feed and bills to pay, etc., and they're trying to make their way within the system that we've been given as well. So it's not an easy situation for anyone. And my sympathies are out there for people who are in that situation right now.
Absolutely. Well, I think you've given a really balanced and rational answer to that question, and something that, you know, people can actually apply to their lives if they are indeed working as a teacher. Final question for you, James, something that's very topical right now, particularly in the United States, is the issue of student loan debt. Seems like every week we're reading about some PhD graduate who's saddled with six figures or more of debt. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that the student loans are instruments to saddle people further, or, you know, do they exist to help people get the education that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise be able to get. What are your thoughts on that?
This is a case of where the government steps in to give aid, quote unquote, to a system. What it does is end up skewing the regular market forces that would be in play for that system and skewing things towards where it becomes basically unavailable for people who don't have that government aid, quote unquote. So where we see that, for example, with heavy interference in the marketplace for medicine in the United States, we see exorbitant medical rates that are just ridiculous, that can't be paid by the average person, which necessitates the industry of the insurance, which then can be further supplemented by the government, which further skews the market, etc. And in the exact same way, I think we see this, a similar thing with the education system, where the government steps in with these loans, quote unquote, that of course have to be, that all come due when you leave the education system. And it is a sort of system that has been set up that does put students into a type of debt slavery from the day they end up graduating. And I can't necessarily fault the system itself, because the students, of course, have knowingly and willingly and voluntarily signed up to that. So anyone who goes into that, taking out that exorbitant loan, knows what they're getting into. And to a certain extent, you can argue, well, if you want to be a doctor, you have to go to medical school. If you have to go to medical school, you have to pay these exorbitant fees. And if you have to pay these exorbitant fees and you don't have the money, you have to take out a loan. So it is a vicious circle that's created by the system as it's been presented itself. But I think that the answer certainly can't be simply to ask the government to rob other people of more money in order to further subsidize students in order to help to pay their education. I don't think that that's the parsimonious answer that we're all looking for. I think what we have to do, again, is to start at least questioning how it is that we can start to transform the expectations of society so that every young person really needs a college degree or college education. Otherwise, they're just unemployable except for garbage men or something like that. I mean, that's the type of mindset that we've come into in the last several decades, and it is absolutely ridiculous. If we had an education, a post-secondary education system that in any way resembled what the market out there actually needs and desires and wants and would like to achieve, I don't think it would look anything like what we see right now, with people going to school for 4 years to get a degree, for example, in my case, in English, and then becoming teachers and then becoming website proprietors. I mean, I look back on my post-secondary education with some regret. I mean, I do value the experiences I had, the people I met, what I did. I don't really regret that. But looking back and thinking of the money that I paid for this education, which has not served me well in any real respect, then there was nothing during that 4 years that I couldn't have learned on my own time by myself and would have anyways, because it was what I was naturally interested in. So again, I think we have to start fundamentally questioning the system. And if we had a system where, for example, people were not necessarily expected to go to university and people were judged more on the merits of what they were capable of and what they were talented at, I think we would start to see a return to something more like rationality in the post-secondary education, where post-secondary education would really be for people who actually need it, for doctors, for engineers, for people who are going into specific trades. And I think we would see, if we saw some of the government intervention in that marketplace getting out of the way, I think we'd see some sort of return to more realistic figures in terms of what an education actually costs. So I think there's a lot of things that are skewing this, and one of the most fundamental is just, again, our expectations as a society that post-secondary education is necessary for vast swaths of the population, especially in this day and age where the access to technologies to educate ourselves are so widely available.
Absolutely. James, this has been fantastic as usual. We want to thank you so much for your time. I just want to give you the opportunity to get the word out there about anything that's coming up on the Corbett Report website. The floor is yours. Let us know what people can expect in the next few weeks.
Well, I just want to let people know that, of course, I've been on my Christmas / New Year break, but I will be coming back in the next few days and things will be returning to normal, except for the fact that my radio show, my weekday radio show, which used to air at 9 p.m. Central every weekday on RBN, will not be returning in the new year. That was just too much of a time commitment for me, and especially as I'm about to become a father, I will probably...
Oh, many congratulations.
Congratulations. Well, thank you for that.
Yes. So in May, I'm going to be, we're going to have our first child. Wow. So I will be becoming a stay-at-home dad, and I'll start putting some of this theory into practice in terms of education, etc. So in preparation for that, I'm getting rid of the daily radio show, but I'll still be continuing my podcast, my interviews, my videos, my articles, and in fact, increasing that with some new podcast series and video series that will be coming out shortly. So people can just stay tuned to CorbettReport.com for all of that, and you can subscribe to the RSS feeds, obviously for free, just to stay in touch with what I'm doing. And also, I'll be posting this interview on my own website, so if you guys want to give out your contact details, again, your website and your YouTube channel, and people can find that.
Excellent. Well, again, many congratulations, James, and it's so great to see everything that you're involved in. You've made a huge contribution to alternative news, and it's just great to see that you're going from strength to strength. For people listening to this who it might be your first exposure to our podcast, the website is smellslikehumanspirit.com, and you can find a full archive of all of our episodes there. You can also find us on iTunes, YouTube. The account is Smells Like Podcast. We're also on Twitter. The handle is Smells Like Pod, so you can keep up to date with us there. And we also have a Facebook group. It's just facebook.com/, you guessed it, Smells Like Human Spirit. And we have quite a budding community on there now, and some good discussions. We post articles and links to documentaries as well as the podcast themselves. So for anyone listening to this, I definitely encourage you to check all that out as well.
Great. Thank you, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, James.